Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Inside. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Tonight is opening night for the Sacramento Kings. While they'll be away in Portland to begin the season, the Kings return Friday for their home opener against the Utah Jazz. It'll mark the fifth home opener at Golden One Center, but it will also mark the first time since the pandemic that fans will be allowed back in. Those cardboard cutouts of fans will be taking a back seat. Now, whether you're a sports fan or not, the landscape of the city center has changed dramatically in that time, with the arena as its anchor. I was there 5 years ago as Sir Paul McCartney became the inaugural headliner. Since then, the arena has hosted every kind of event you can pretty much think of, from rodeos, Disney on Ice, graduation ceremonies. But as most things, or all things, the pandemic shuttered events and surrounding businesses. Well, now the arena is open. Concerts are back. And so are the Kings, of course, with precautions. Joining us is John Reinhart, Director of Business Operations of the Sacramento Kings, meaning he is in charge of all things Golden One Center. Mr. Reinhart, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Vicky. Thank you. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Well, anyone who's lived here really long enough knows just about the struggle to get the Golden One Center approved, paid for, and built. There were a lot of promises made about how the arena would revitalize downtown, and a lot has changed in the 5 years since it's been there. We have hotels in development, like bookending the arena in addition to the Kimpton Sawyer, that's really helping that hotel occupancy that has really been a drought in our city center, not to mention the businesses. Can you talk about the economic impact the arena has had in the last 5 years?
Yeah, you know, I think it's great. As you said, I think the whole plan to put Golden One Center downtown at the center of our city was really to help that revitalization of our city, to kind of make our downtown really a destination and not just a place where, you know, people would come in and work and then leave at 5 o'clock. It's somewhere where people can come in the evenings during the week, but also on the weekends and enjoy their friends and families and really perfect strangers in such a great lifestyle of arts and entertainment. And really a lifestyle district. So, you know, since Golden One Center has been built, there's been so many great developments around it. Not only, you know, the development that we did here at DOCO, which has just a vibrant restaurant scene and great retail scene, and then the Sawyer Hotel, but like you said, some other hotels that are being booked, built right on the outside of it. And then all the other developments, there's been, you know, close to 60 brand new construction projects right in our center core of our downtown since Golden One Center has been built. And people are now starting to come and live downtown. As you know, we have, you know, residents right here at the Sawyer, on top of the Sawyer Hotel, where people are living every day. And now more and more residential units are starting to pop up. So I think it's done exactly what we planned it to do. And Vivek's vision of having the arena be that center point of growth of our downtown region. And it's just going to get better from there.
And we're talking about dozens of businesses and also peripheral areas such as K Street and Old Town Sacramento, which is now the waterfront. Of all of that, what are the arena's most defining moments and most defining impacts in the past 5 years?
You know, I think the biggest defining impact was really just having our downtown light up again. As we all know, the city of Sacramento, as great as it always has been one where people would come into work, like I said, and then leave and go home to their residence and really stay there and not stay downtown to dine and to shop. But since Golden One Center has been built and everything around it, people do come downtown. You know, I've been down here on the weekends and it's really bustling. And like you said, it's going all the way from the waterfront and now to our newly renovated convention center all the way down through K Street with businesses and restaurants and shops opening up. You know, I think the one defining thing that I would just point to is just that overall revitalization of our downtown core, which is the capital of California, which is the fourth or fifth largest economy in the world.
Yeah. And that was compromised during the pandemic, as pretty much all things. And these operations and these businesses, they are expensive to run. How were they supported over the last 18 months, especially in the beginning of the pandemic when everything was essentially just closed down?
Yeah, it was extremely tough for everybody. I don't think anybody was spared from the hardships of the pandemic. I think the one thing we did learn is that the region of Sacramento and the people of Sacramento are tremendously resilient and persevere, and they also support each other. So I think not only did businesses support each other, but the residents supported each other. We supported, the downtown local businesses when Doco. We did things like opened up Doco Al Fresco, which allowed all of our Doco restaurants to provide outdoor dining where they otherwise didn't have the space. So they could still keep their doors open, invite patrons in to enjoy their food and enjoy their atmosphere. And that happened all around the city. You know, you saw all the sidewalk cafes and, you know, the outdoor dining that happened. It really proved that, one, Sacramentans love to be outside and they love to enjoy the weather and the resources that we have. And they also love to, you know, enjoy friends and sometimes perfect strangers in those atmospheres.
And now looking ahead, there are over 80 new projects in the works in and around the arena and downtown corridor. What are some that you can share or that you're excited about?
It really, really, really exciting. One is one that, you know, just got announced yesterday, which was the Sutherland company buying Lot X and partnering with us in that transaction in order to build a high rise residential units. Really the first of its kind, where it'll be around 25 stories of downtown living. And also on the bottom, it'll have retail shops and restaurants like we're all accustomed to. So really starting to look at those type of projects that bring people downtown permanently, bring people down here to live, to work, to play, is all the things that I think we envisioned when we built Golden One Center in the center of downtown.
Is that the high rise coming on 3rd Street and Capitol?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, when it comes to the pandemic, I mean, it shut down the arena for such a long stretch of time. And this was really in, you know, relatively the infancy of this arena. How did the arena really adapt to these shutdowns? And what has the process been like just getting back open and ready to welcome people back?
You know, it's been something like no one could ever plan for. Like, we are a business that, you know, its primary business is to bring people together in large crowds to enjoy the atmosphere and to enjoy each other's company. And that really was completely shut down, as you said, during the pandemic. So we had to really adapt and try to find ways to, one, you know, we instantly went into the mode of how do we reopen? How do we reopen quickly and how do we reopen safely to make sure all of our patrons and our guests and our team members that work here can do it in a way that keeps them safe and secure, but also provides an experience that people can't get at home. So we wanted to be ready as soon as we got the word from the state and the local governments that it was okay to start reopening. We wanted to make sure that we could. So we spent a lot of time on those health and safety protocols. We went out and we got accreditations in a couple different ways. We got the GBAC accreditation, and then we got the WELL health and safety rating. And that really, they both were focused on different areas. One was focused on actual cleaning and protocols and that type of stuff. And the other was actually the operations side and making sure that the operations that you had were following safety and health protocols in kind of an accredited way. So we were one of the first buildings in the country to actually get both of those accreditations. And it just showed that that's really where our focus was. How do we make sure that when people come back, we knew that eventually people were going to be able to come back. But when they did, make sure that they could do it in a safe and secure manner and that they felt that way.
Dealing with such a fluid situation, what was the biggest hurdle? Just getting back up and running.
I think you hit it on the head there. It's the fluidity. You know, it seemed like the rules were changing every day. The goalposts were moving every day. So we really had to be very nimble. You know, we had to be able to make sure we were building a plan, but not get offended when that plan had to change the next day because, you know, the guidelines changed. So we just wanted to make sure that we could adapt with whatever the environment was giving us. And we worked very closely with the state and the local county health departments and as well as the MBA to make sure that we were staying on cutting edge and staying on top of everything to make sure that we could be fluid in those matters. So it was really just making sure that, you know, no matter how hard you plan for something, you know, never get offended if it was never going to get used. We just wanted to be prepared.
When it comes to people who are going to be entering the Golden One Center for the first time since the pandemic, what should they know? What COVID protocols are in place?
Well, first, they should know that we welcome them back. Like, we can't wait to see them back here at Golden One Center. You know, I've really missed seeing everybody's faces at all of the events, especially Kings games. And, you know, I think what they know is that it's going to be a very safe and secure manner. And some of the protocols in place is, you're required to show your vaccine, that you're fully vaccinated when you come to the arena, or that you have had a negative COVID test within 48 hours or 2 days of the actual event. And then once you show that, you come into the arena like you normally would, but you will be asked to wear a mask. So masks are mandated here in the state and the county. So you'll have to wear a mask while you're at the event, unless, of course, you're actively eating and drinking either in your seat, or we have some designated eating and drinking areas in the concourse as well.
Well, you've been able to see how this has really been going with previous concerts and events that already have been taking place at Golden One Center. And there's some social media accounts just showing long lines getting into the arena at some recent events. Is that because of those protocols?
Yeah, I think it's just everybody really being patient, and our fans and our guests have shown a great deal of patience. There are different levels of protocols that we do have to enact right now that we haven't in the past. And really the main one is that showing the proof of the vaccine or the proof of the negative COVID test. You know, some people are not used to that. So when they're coming up to the lines, they don't necessarily have it prepared. So we work with them, we wait, and we get, you know, get them what they need either on their phone or the hard copy. And identify that it is actually the right person, and then we'll let them in. But a lot of that, I think, will dismiss as time goes, as people get used to, you know, when should I arrive at the arena? You know, maybe I come a little bit early, so make sure that I can get through the lines. We're also doing some things like pre-checking. So if you want to come down to DOCO in the middle of the day, we have a tent set up where you can actually get verified early and get a wristband. So you could actually go through the line much quicker. You don't have to take out your proof of vaccine or your negative COVID test. So we're trying to do things like that to help speed up the experience and the environment, knowing that, you know, our guests want to get inside. So we're going to do the best we can.
Yeah. I mean, that's good to know about that booth, because it's being proactive if you want to not wait in that line.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
When it comes to employment, I mean, an overarching problem for a lot of companies during this time is just hiring people. And just looking at the site, I mean, there's a good amount of job openings, for positions to be filled from like elevator operators, food service handlers, security. Will people ultimately feel the effect when they go to a game or an event?
You know, finding workers and employment has definitely been a challenge for everybody in the region. And we've been working very hard to make sure we're filling those spots. I would say we will make sure that the guests that come in will not notice any difference in service or guest experience. You know, we make sure that no matter who we have working in the building, that, you know, we're doing the things that are going to enhance that guest experience and make sure that our guests can get in and out, you know, the way they need to and the way they want to, and also enjoy the experience while they're there. So we're in very good shape there, and the team members that we do have are tremendous. You know, our arena and everybody that works in the arena, you know, I just think are the best in the world. And you know, I may be biased, but you know, I see them every day, and I can't be more proud of them.
Well, given that we're not out of the woods just yet, what are the outlying challenges as you continue to scale up?
I think a lot of it is the education and communication piece of what, you know, what it is like to come to an event again, you know, post pandemic, and, you know, making sure people understand that, you know, they can enjoy the events just like they did prior to the pandemic, and that they can do it in a safe and secure manner, and also in a manner that's not really that burdensome to them. They can come in and sit down and really enjoy what they're there to see, whether it be a Kings game or a concert or a Disney on Ice show, or, you know, you name it, whatever type of entertainment people like. You know, the challenges, I think, is just building back that confidence in our region that it's okay. And, you know, we're ready to reopen as a region. Our businesses are ready to reopen, and we're all here to welcome people back.
Have there been sold out events so far?
Yeah. Yes. We've had, you know, several sold out concerts, you know, in the past couple of weeks. You know, our Kings games will be certainly sold out as we go forward here. And then, you know, we'll continue to build from there.
Well, speaking of the Kings, before we let you go, we're going to welcome them on Friday at Golden One Center. What's planned for this event?
You know, we just can't wait to have people back in full capacity for a regular season game. As you said, it's been, you know, almost 2 years since we've been able to do that. And so we have a lot of fun things, you know, planned. You know, one of the big things is we've just announced that we're going to have Montel Jordan, you know, platinum winning singer and songwriter, perform the national anthem and perform a halftime act. But Montel will also be doing a studio session, you know, prior to the game, with some mentors of California to celebrate their commitment to the youth of our region, and just, you know, give them his perspective of, you know, his career and what he's gone through to get to where he's at today, and what his outlook is going forward. On top of that, you know, of course, we have our 916 crew that will be performing a lot of great in-game entertainment stuff. But best of all, we're going to have the Kings on the court again at Golden 1 Center in front of a packed crowd. Best fans in the world. So it's going to be fun and exciting. We can't wait.
John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. That is John Reinhart, the Director of Business Operations for the Sacramento Kings. Up next, political maps are redrawn every 10 years, and there is a lot at stake. We'll break down some of the basics and just get you up to speed on where things stand right now. Also, as PG&E wildfire victims await promised compensation, we'll explain who's already cashing out billions from Wall Street. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Every decennial, that's just a fancy word for decade, our political kaleidoscope morphs with the intention to better reflect the state's demographics. And right now, that's taking shape. Every 10 years following the census, an independent commission redraws boundaries for elected positions at the federal, state, and local level. And really, a lot is at stake, because the makeup of each district, however it's drawn, will shape communities' interests by moving some voices to nearby districts and ultimately away from others. Election guru and Insight regular Paul Mitchell, he had a great analogy in a recent San Francisco Chronicle article, saying it's like drawing a jigsaw puzzle. You know, it just has to be just right. So, with that in mind, because it's been a minute, a refresher is in store. Cap Radio political reporter Nicole Nixon will be following California's redistricting process from start to finish and joins us with more on where things stand today. Welcome back, Nicole.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Who makes up this Citizens Redistricting Commission, and how are they appointed?
Yeah, there are 14 members of this commission. It's got 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, and 4 people with no party preference, or they could be affiliated with another party besides those two. And they go through this very intense vetting process. They submit this long application, an essay. Lawyers in the state auditor's office narrowed this pool of thousands of applicants down to about 60. And sent those names to leaders in the state legislature, and they were able to toss out some names, kind of giving everybody an opportunity to block people they might have had concerns about. And then after that, the state auditor held this lottery-style drawing for names and chose 8 members of the commission. Then those members went through the remaining applications to finish out the rest of their body. So long process. This happened earlier this year. And just one more quick note, the redistricting commission we're talking about today is the state commission. So they'll draw maps for congressional, legislative, and board of equalization districts. The cities and counties will have their own process for getting their own maps.
So when it comes to state and congressional, what are the basic rules and guidelines in redrawing political boundaries?
Yeah, California's commission is constitutionally bound by this list of priorities. The number one thing is that all districts have to have equal population, or at least as much as possible, because, you know, you'll never get every single district exactly equal. They also have to comply with the Voting Rights Act, which prohibits voting practices that discriminate based on race. And this means the commission is making a really concerted effort not to split up communities of color and dilute their voices. And then the other thing they have to, as much as possible, keep areas together as much as possible, like cities, you know, counties and communities of interest. And so there could be a big farming community, you know, or an area that has a large Latino population, just not splitting those up willy-nilly either.
Well, remind us of the criticism this process has historically received.
Yeah, the thing we hear about with redistricting is gerrymandering, and that's when districts are drawn to protect incumbents or give electoral advantage to one political party or another. In California, we have this independent commission. Remember, though, that 20 years ago, the legislature was drawing the political maps, and that's still the case in many other states. So critics say that amounts to lawmakers choosing their own voters. And experts say that the commission, you know, this is their second go around in California. They think they do a pretty good job, or better than the legislature did, at least when it comes to, you know, keeping everything fair.
So given now that there's this independent commission in California and that differs from other states, is there any pushback that's happening right now in California?
You know, I don't know if I would call it pushback, but the commission's just getting the feedback they're supposed to be getting, at least at this point. They've put out a few versions of potential mapping ideas. They're holding these long meetings that are just to hear from residents, you know, hours long of public comment. And there are some interesting conversations going on. A lot of Asian American residents around the state calling in to say that they want their communities to stay together. This is especially happening in Sacramento and the Bay Area. There's talk about a congressional district in the South Bay area that would be majority Asian American and Pacific Islander, and there aren't many of those in the country. I think that some of that more critical pushback will come after we see the first draft maps next month, and then again when the final versions are adopted. But this commission, you know, I talked to the chair yesterday, and she recognizes this too, that they're not going to be able to make everybody happy. Hmm.
You know, as we know, California is losing a congressional seat. How does that throw a wrench into this process?
Yeah, you know, the state's population has shifted so much over the past 10 years that districts would change anyway. We'll see some representation shift probably away from the LA area, where the population grew the slowest, toward the Bay Area and here in Sacramento. That means some of the districts around here may get a little bit smaller because there's more people in them. And in the LA area, those legislative and congressional districts may get a bit bigger to compensate for fewer people. But yeah, the loss of a congressional seat will be a big deal. We just don't know how it will play out yet because those maps aren't drawn.
We're still weeks away or into this process. What are the big deadlines that you're watching?
Yeah, the commission has to have a set of draft maps by November 15th, next month. They'll take feedback on those and have the final maps to the Secretary of State by right around Christmas. And they're in the phase right now where they're drawing maps and getting feedback. So anybody can call in or, you know, look at those, call in and write with input on their website.
Finally, before we let you go, Nicole, you're going to be following this process to the finish line. Anything surprising you in your reporting so far?
I don't know how, it's not a huge surprise, but it's just really interesting to me how the politics of redistricting is just not so much a focus here. You know, there are pockets like Orange County where Republicans and Democrats are, you know, kind of tussling over the lines. But the priority for this commission is to keep communities of interest together as much as possible. So other states are having arguments about partisan gerrymandering, but at the state level here, it's so much talk about making sure communities of color are not split up between districts, and it, especially because California is such a diverse state, there are so many of these diverse communities.
Thanks for following this, Nicole, and joining us.
Thank you.
And that is CAP Radio political reporter Nicole Nixon. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. Accountability, justice. The meaning behind those words seems straightforward. But if you ask the 70,000 wildfire survivors who lost loved ones, homes, businesses, community, in wildfires sparked by PG&E equipment from 2015 to 2018, many feel the empty weight behind those words. Words which promise compensation for death and destruction. Many victims are still awaiting their settlements. And if you take the drive up to those burn scars, as I have, you'll see that translates into trailers on lots and a purgatory of trauma, years after their lives as they knew it became unrecognizable. But others are cashing in. Big time. KQED and the California Newsroom pored over documents from the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, or the SEC, and found that 20 Wall Street hedge funds have dumped millions of PG&E stock, walking away with billions of dollars. According to reporting by KQED's California Report co-host Lily Jamali, many of the hedge funds didn't pay a cent for a majority of that stock. The agreement was meant to support the utility giant client during bankruptcy. Lily has been following PG&E's bankruptcy story for years now, and she joins us again with the paper trail. Lily, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks for having me on, Vicki.
First off, Lily, remind us about the intention behind the Fire Victims Trust for survivors.
The Fire Victim Trust was set up as part of PG&E's settlement with these 70 to 80,000 fire survivors across those years that you mentioned, 2015 to 2018. And it was set up to distribute what was promised to be $13.5 billion to all of these fire survivors. That $13.5 billion number turns out to be not quite that amount. It's actually quite a bit less. And as we've talked about on your show before, you know, half of the money was funded as stock of PG&E, of the company. So these fire survivors now hold a quarter of PG&E, believe it or not. And so as the stock fluctuates, the amount of their distributions, the amount of their compensation changes as well. The thing to know, though, is on day one, when PG&E funded that compensation to this Fire Victim Trust, it was already about $2 billion short from the very beginning.
Why have some survivors that you've spoken to not received their settlements yet?
Yeah, you know, it's been over a year since the PG&E bankruptcy was consummated and this Fire Victim Trust was formally set up. And, you know, even going into that July 2020 date, there were about 5 to 6 months of runway that the administrators of the trust were supposed to have in order to, you know, set up the systems and get everything in place to get this money out the door. You know, there are so many different claims across different fires. You know, I think a charitable view, the most charitable view, is that this type of process is going to take time. It's such a daunting task. But at the same time, as we've reported, you know, there's a lot of money going out the door to other parties, including the administrators, including those who are running the Fire Victim Trust. We did an investigation on that back in May. And what we're trying to do with this latest story about hedge funds is to talk a little bit about how we got to this point. What is it that led to this, what I think you can only call a flawed outcome for so many victims? Because you use the term purgatory of trauma. I can't think of a better or more apt phrase to describe what so many people are going through, are living through every single day, you know, in some cases as many as 6 years after these fires touch their lives.
So how and why did Wall Street step in?
Well, that's the question that we were trying to answer with this story by pouring through hundreds of these SEC filings. You can look at, through these filings, a snapshot in time of what the portfolios of these various hedge funds looks like. It's sort of like a sneak peek. You can see how many shares of every company that they own they hold. And the filings tell a story, and that story begins after the 2017 North Bay fires, where you see PG&E stock basically get slashed in half almost. And so these hedge funds evidently see an opportunity to get involved. They think that, you know, the company's in distress and that they might be able to cash in on that. But after the 2018 campfire happens, that investment, at least on paper, turns sour on these hedge funds. And we see the stock fall to new lows. It goes even lower when PG&E voluntarily files for Chapter 11 a couple weeks after the campfire. And so suddenly these hedge funds are pretty, you know, in the red on this investment decision that they had made. And so they have a choice. And some of them decide to go even deeper into this investment and get so involved that they're able to exert control over PG&E. They're able to pick members of the board. And so once PG&E is in bankruptcy, we see an outgrowth of that being these various settlements that PG&E strikes, including the one with fire survivors, including the one that has left these fire survivors holding a quarter of PG&E stock. And these hedge funds, what we're seeing now is that a year after the PG&E bankruptcy ended, even though, you know, some of the people went on, you know, national television and said, you know, we're not going to all bail out on PG&E right away. That's in fact what a lot of these hedge funds have done. Of the 20 hedge funds that we looked at, 7 of them have completely sold out of their shares. Another one called Appaloosa, which is run by a very famous Wall Street investor named David Tepper, they're out 80% on their investment at this point. And there are others that are, you know, in the 50 to 60% range. They're out the door to a lesser extent, but still, you know, that is going to put a certain amount of pressure on the stock. And so that's really important for fire survivors who, through this trust, they have to sell this mound of stock of about almost 500 million shares of PG&E stock in order to get cash that they can then use to, you know, rebuild homes and move on. And so at this point, as far as we know, the Fire Victim Trust has not sold a single share. The stock price is doing a little bit better in these recent weeks. Over the last 2-3 weeks, the conditions have gotten a little bit better. That might be because I think there's a more optimistic view of this fire season that we're in. But the bottom line is the fortunes, the compensation is really tethered to how PG&E performs as a company. And that's really unfortunate for so many victims.
Going back to these hedge funds, why would giving away shares for free ultimately help PG&E and wildfire victims who are shareholders?
Yeah, well, if you got a hedge fund on the line with us, they would really push back on the word free. And we went back and forth a lot on that with them. And the way we're saying it is that they got them at no cost. They did not pay a cent for about 170 million shares that appear in PG&E's annual statement as a $1.5 billion cost. Those are hard numbers, and they're in the financial documents that the company has to submit to the SEC. The reason that this share giveaway took place is because as PG&E was leaving bankruptcy, in order to fund various settlements, including the one with fire survivors, as they tell it, they needed to have insurance that they'd be able to sell PG&E shares into the market. And there was some concern, given the volatility that the stock had experienced, that they might not have a lot of takers. So essentially, these hedge funds stepped up and said, we'll buy shares if nobody else wants them. We're going to give you, you know, a very low but fixed price for those shares. We'll buy them at that price. But, you know, regardless, we're going to get our fee, which is this 170 million share giveaway. And so ultimately, there was a market for PG&E shares. They didn't end up having to buy them, but they did end up collecting this fee. And so, you know, some of these shares they bought, you know, at a certain price, call it $10. Others bought it at $20. And so this story, you know, in some ways, it's not so much that the hedge funds profited handsomely off of their involvement in PG&E. I think the real story is that they managed to salvage what ended up being a very bad investment decision that they made on the backs of these tragedies that were happening to us here in California. So, you know, some of this share giveaway, those are shares that they're selling off at no cost. You know, they're making pure profit off of those. The rest of them, they're making whatever the gain or the loss is. But you know, you can see it in the filings that they are trying, they're fighting tooth and nail to make sure that that fee goes from what was originally 120 million shares of PG&E to 170 million. Obviously, this backstop fee was really important to the hedge funds.
Throughout your investigations, you've also built relationships over the years with wildfire survivors. How are they doing and what are they telling you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's such a spectrum of experiences. I've had the privilege of traveling as far away as Tennessee to document the climate change migration of these fire survivors. You know, I know that folks at CAP Radio have done an amazing job documenting the experience here in our region as well. And, you know, you have people who did okay, you know, who obviously suffered a tragedy and suffered trauma, but maybe their insurance companies didn't give them such a hard time. So they were able to move move on and rebuild a home or buy a new home somewhere else. But there are so many people that are still living in this, you know, transitory state, stuck in campers and trailers and RVs for years and years on end. In fact, we spoke with someone named Terry McBride, who is a Butte fire victim in Calaveras County. She's been in this trailer for 6 years with her daughter. And I think we have a clip of her. We shared our findings on this hedge fund story, and here's what she told us.
We lost every single thing. And these folks want to make sure their pockets are padded. How in the hell do they look in the mirror? Put that in there. How do they look in the mirror? What part of humanity do they belong to?
And Lily, the Butte fire was like in 2015, correct?
That's right. And you can hear, you know, the angst and frustration in her voice. She was actually saying, put this in there. I want people to hear this particular part of what I'm saying. What part of humanity do these people belong to? You know, as a former financial reporter and someone who spent a lot of time on the East Coast in my career, you know, I think that it does, when you talk to some of these hedge fund managers, believe it or not, I do think they care how they are viewed by the public. They do a lot of, they make a lot of effort to try to do charitable works and philanthropic works, and they really want people to know about that. And so, you know, on a number of occasions when I would talk to some of these folks, the first thing they would say on the phone was, hey, Lily, I just want you to know, you know, we've done a lot of work. We've done a lot of contributions to some of these efforts. I've visited Paradise. But, you know, the truth is, if you're not in the region and you're not living that reality that someone like Terry McBride is living in Calaveras County, there's just no way you understand. There's just no way to really own that experience. And, you know, one of the positives is that I have had to get on the phone with some of these hedge fund managers and explain to them what the outcome of this deal has been. I want them to know that because it's really important. And if you're in New York and you're, you know, 3,000 miles away and the worst impacts you see are a couple of days of wildfire smoke this particular year, but generally you're pretty insulated, it's really hard to, I think, truly appreciate how difficult this situation has been. One of the outcomes of our story has been we did get a lot of coverage and a lot of interest in this story. And one of the things that people have come to me and said in the, you know, week or two since it's been out is, you know, Lily, this stock compensation thing that ended up happening to these fire survivors was not the idea of PG&E. It was not the idea of the hedge funds. It was the idea of the lawyers for the wildfire survivors. That's where it came from. And I think that's really important because for a long time, there's been a mystery around who, you know, would ever have conceived of such a thing. But increasingly, the finger is being pointed at the attorneys who I think you could argue they wanted perhaps to expand the amount of the pie, you know, the amount of compensation that was available. But on the other hand, yeah, got to remember that fire survivors are the only party in this case that got not only deferred cash payments, their cash payments are coming over three installments, unlike everyone else who got their cash on day one, but they are also the only party that got stock. And, you know, I think a lot of people look at this and say, of all the groups, of the insurance companies, of the hedge funds, of the cities and counties that got money in these settlements, fire survivors were the last group who should have had to deal with an outcome like this.
Bigger picture, I mean, PG&E is still being connected to wildfires following 2018. I mean, the utility giant is facing manslaughter charges in the deadly Zog fire near Shasta. The Dixie fire is being investigated as well as it continues to burn. I mean, and PG&E also is supposed to be catching up on years, decades of maintenance, not to mention wildfire prevention. So how does this shape or hinder those mitigation plans? We have wildfire seasons that are essentially years now.
This is such an important point that you're making, Vicki. I think for a lot of us, you know, the rest of us who haven't been through a fire, this story can feel like it is someone else's issue, even though we might feel compassion about what they're going through. It's sort of not everyone's problem, but what you're talking about really is everyone's problem. This idea that PG&E is still very vulnerable to causing another fire. I mean, as you say, they're being investigated for the Dixie fire, which is the largest of the year, the second largest in California history. And what these hedge funds engineered in this bankruptcy was an outcome where they end up with this massive share giveaway and they leave a company behind that is heavily in debt. You know, they basically almost doubled their debt when you look at the before and after the Chapter 11 process. And the debt load is only increasing in the year since PG&E left bankruptcy. So, you know, that's a really strange outcome for a bankruptcy. Most of the time, the Chapter 11 process is about getting a company into a better, sounder financial position. And here you have a situation where they actually ended up with a ton more debt. And, you know, I think that might not strike people as odd, but for people who are scholars of bankruptcy, there is nothing normal about that. And so if you're that in debt and you're talking about an undergrounding project, people might remember the CEO of PG&E talking about this a couple of months ago, right after the Dixie Fire. They made this big announcement of undergrounding about an eighth of their lines.
Right.
The cost of $15 to $30 billion. Unbelievable amount of money. When you look at the company's balance sheet, they have $40 billion of debt on their balance sheet right now. So a $30 billion undergrounding project, you know, good luck funding that. I mean, that's going to end up on the shoulders of ratepayers who are facing 20% increases. That's the ask that PG&E currently has in with the CPUC.
Yeah, I mean, and before we let you go, that was going to be my next point. I mean, we're rightfully talking about wildfire survivors shouldering the weight of supporting a company that caused this destruction and death in their communities, but they're all ratepayers. PG&E has some, you know, 16 million customers. So ultimately, this will get passed off to them as well.
That's right. And it's happening at a time when, you know, we need PG&E to be shoring up its system more than ever. We are, you know, looking at parts of a system that are over a century old at this point. And I know you have studied the Camp Fire well. You know that it was the result of a broken hook that snapped after years and years, a century of wear. You know, I think to their credit, we talk to critics of the company all the time, and to PG&E's credit, there is a sense that they are stepping up on inspections, that they are paying a lot more attention to vegetation management. But when you think about how far behind they were when they started all this, there's just so much work to do, and it's going to take a lot of money to do it.
Lily, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Vicki.
And that is Lily Jamali with KQED and the California Newsroom about her latest investigation into Wall Street hedge funds cashing out billions in PG&E stock as thousands of wildfire survivors wait. Still ahead, a new year, a new slate of honorees. We're going to celebrate the 2021 inductees to the California Hall of Fame. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Well, everyone's heard of the Baseball Hall of Fame, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. There's even a Circus Hall of Fame. That's new to me. Well, right here in Sacramento, we have the California Hall of Fame through the California Museum. The museum just recently announced its latest group of inductees with the 14th round of honorees. With us to talk about the new online exhibit showcasing these Californians is Amanda Meeker with the California Museum. Hello, Amanda.
Yeah, good morning, Vicki.
You know, previous Hall of Famers have been entertainers and actors like RuPaul, athletes such as Magic Johnson, Serena Williams, writers Amy Tan, Dr. Seuss. What qualifies someone to be inducted into California's Hall of Fame?
Well, there are a number of categories that we look at people in: arts, entertainment, science. But really, it comes down to making a difference that goes even beyond the borders of our state. So these are all people who have, within their own fields, really shown. And there are so many people like that in California.
Well, the latest round of California Hall of Famers, there's musicians Jerry Garcia, Richie Valens, La Bamba, they've been honored. But there are also some lesser known Californians. Can you talk to us about Ruth Asawa?
Yeah, Ruth Asawa to me is so interesting because her work, and she, you know, may not be a household name to everyone, but if you see her work, you'll never forget it. She's using materials that you might not think of becoming art. She's really known for her wire sculptures and taking just simple wire and weaving it into these shapes, these complex forms that are really evocative of nature and are just light and gorgeous.
When you think of the United Farm Workers, you know, Cesar Chavez comes to mind, Dolores Huerta, but you're also honoring labor activist Larry Itliong, who's a Filipino-American labor activist with United Farm Workers. Talk to us about his significance and his contributions.
Yeah, Larry is one of those, you know, people, like you just said, we all kind of know Cesar Chavez, and we're starting to know more Dolores Huerta. But Larry Itliong is still not a household name, and he really should be. I think we're all familiar with the grape strike and boycott of the 1960s. That was one of the most significant labor actions in our country's history, really pivotal to getting better conditions and wages for farm workers. And it was actually Larry Itliong who started that strike. And I think so many people don't know that. He started that strike, I think a full week, and went, you know, he realized at that point there were the Filipino American workers that he was part of, and there were the Mexican American workers that Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta were leading. And the growers would tend to use those two groups against each other to keep wages low, to keep conditions really pretty poor. And Larry really realized, you know, we've got to work together if we're ever going to make progress for the workers. And so he went to Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta and said, you know, will you come in with us on this strike? And they did. And, you know, the rest is history.
Yeah. I mean, you have such a spectrum of honorees for this year. They're gay rights activists, Phyllis Leon and Del Martin. They're journalists, pioneers in the LGBTQ plus community, the first legal same-sex union, I think, not only obviously in California, but in the country, correct?
Yeah, they were the first couple, first same-sex couple to marry. That was in San Francisco in 2004. So that was during that period of time in which then Mayor Gavin Newsom said, let's go ahead and give licenses to same-sex couples. They had been in a loving relationship for 50 years, had never had the ability to marry, of course. I mean, they could have gone to Canada, but not within this country. And they went ahead and married. And then shortly thereafter, the Supreme Court, California Supreme Court, ruled that their marriage was invalid. So they had to keep on fighting. Of course, lots of history went on then. Eventually, the court then ruled in 2008 that same-sex marriages were legal. They married again. This time, Mayor Newsom married them again in 2008. And sadly, Del passed away shortly after that. But they did, you know, get the chance to finally, you know, marry after all those years together and all of that work advancing LGBTQ rights. They did, you know, they were firsts in many, many avenues in that regard.
The three inductees that we're talking about, they all have passed away. I'm curious, was there a reason why you chose these Californians now, or do you curate based on Californians' timeless contributions to the Golden State? In about the last minute or so that we have here.
Yeah, so actually, I mean, just to be clear, the governor and first partner are the ones who choose the inductees every year. That's been the case ever since Arnold Schwarzenegger and Maria Shriver started the event. So they choose them, but with input from the museum, we keep a running list of nominees that we encourage the public to add to. We're always looking for new ideas. But they, this year, were really interested in, you know, it's an entirely posthumous class. It was a virtual class, so a couple of new things this year. We do have lots of information about them online, and you can watch the ceremony online as well at cahalloffame.org. But they were chosen, you know, there's a lot of times you want to, in the in-person, there's always a lot of pressure to have living people. And this was really an opportunity to honor some of those amazing lights of the past.
Amanda, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Vicki.
Amanda Meeker is with the California Museum. And that's it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.